Welcome to Trending in Education, also AI and Ed. Welcome to our listeners. This is Mike Palmer. I'm joined today by Tim Dacey. Tim, welcome back to Trending in Education.
Hey, great to see you again, Michael.
It's amazing to have you. We had you on right after your book, Wisdom Factories, dropped last summer. We had a really interesting conversation when we were at South by Southwest EDU. Beth Rudden referenced a quote that I'm now borrowing religiously, which is, AI is great if you're already wise. AI thinking moves very fast. I'd be curious, from your perspective, how have you been since your book, Wisdom Factories? How's it been in the 8 or so months since the book came out?
It's a whirlwind. If you're trying to stay on top of AI, you know, and I do it as a full-time job,
right?
And AI and its education implications, it is so fast moving as to be sort of dizzying.
Yeah.
And so I find myself having to step back every couple of weeks and just say, how has the landscape changed?
Right.
So as an example, I firmly believe what you just quoted, Beth, but I only partially agree with her. So my book clearly is in line with what she's saying, which is that it's really focused on, we have to have the critical thinking, judgment, wisdom, interpersonal empathy, whatever it is you want to call it. We have to have those, you know, cross-cutting intellectual abilities need to be strong in order to work with AI. Because
yeah,
whereas you might have been doing something detailed and repetitive in your job, it's increasingly, even without AI, increasingly novel and uncertain and multidisciplinary mm-hmm. and all of those things. But there has been some interesting work on evaluating how ChatGPT in particular impacts the workplace. And, you know, I think there's a theme starting to emerge, which is that the people who are really experts and the best performing workers, they aren't benefited by the AI nearly as much as the folks who are novices.
Interesting.
So that's a little bit different than what you're talking about, right? Which is to say, if you don't have those strong intellectual qualities, maybe you do in general, but you're new to a field or whatever, AI can be a crutch.
Right.
Or that, with some danger, right?
That was where I was going. I think that context was more around K-12, where, you know, putting AI in front of a 5-year-old, unchecked, no other humans in the loop. That's potentially a problem. That's certainly a problem. And then moving on from there, at what level are you feeling comfortable allowing a human to interact with an LLM? I think there's an element of, once you develop enough wisdom, once you develop enough judgment, there's less risk in the interaction. But your
point is,
I keep coming back to, you know, the analogy of, you know, high floor, low ceiling, these kinds of things. I feel like our floors have been raised by these things. I think the question is whether the ceiling has been raised yet. And I would view it more as a matter of time, where right now the ability of someone, you know, low performing, getting up to medium performance level is an immediate win. But in the case of the high performers, there's additional cognitive load taken on, there's training time, there's infuriation of, why can't this LLM spit out what I want it to? All those things are challenges that I think higher performers are now dealing with. And ultimately, this circles back to this concept of judgment, which I know we wanted to talk about. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, let's look at the broad trends first. One is that, you know, whatever it is we're doing, AI makes that more abstract and more about orchestration and supervision than it is about doing the work, right? And so if you've been a supervisor or if you've been a teacher, you're used to that kind of dynamic. But that's not most people, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I think some of the work looking at how this impacts the workforce or students is a little bit hard to interpret at this point, because you catch people, you know, a lot of these experiments haven't occurred in an environment where people have already had a lot of experience with the tool.
Right.
Right. So you're seeing a ramp up process in mind. Those who have become really adept with AI and are experts in what they do can really see a boost.
Okay.
Particularly on the creative side.
Right.
That is not how people generally think of these tools. The mm-hmm. first thing you think of these tools is it writes for me.
Right.
I don't like to think of that at all. In fact, I can't stand getting it to write for me because it doesn't say what I want it to say.
Yeah.
And right. But if I am just brainstorming on something or I'm yes. trying to understand how to organize the work or how to think mm-hmm. about it differently.
Yeah.
I always get a little something I could have thought of.
Right.
I have the mm-hmm. expertise to think of because sure. I'm working on it with something that I know a lot about.
Right.
But it was nice to get that. It helped me get there faster.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of Steve Jobs and Think Different. You know, the idea of like, how do I shift the paradigm? Give me something I wouldn't have had entirely by myself. And that's right. where it's almost like an improv partner, a really bad improv partner, actually. Like, it's not particularly funny, but also really good depending on the outputs you're looking for, because a lot of those formats are kind of better understood. I just signed on for the enterprise level of Gemini. I'm already in Google. And just the interoperability of having this sort of through line of my chatbot experience and then my email or my Google Docs, or if I'm creating a presentation, mm-hmm. the idea of a co-pilot is another terminology that I'm hearing a lot. And then how I engage with that, getting back to your point about what I call executive function, you know, the ability to kind of understand as like a manager, as like a coach or a teacher, where does it make sense to use this type of agent, this type of resource? And where does it make sense for me to kind of hold on to these things and kind of do them myself? How is that playing out for you as a consultant? You mentioned brainstorming. Where do you see it make sense to use LLMs nowadays? And where would you argue it's a waste of your time or it's potentially dangerous?
That's a big question. Let me start with how I use it. I personally do a lot of consulting work where I'm building curriculum material, or I'm asked to generate an analysis or report.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is sometimes when I use it for writing, I'll explain why I'm not actually asking it to write. I'm asking yeah. it to co-write, as you said. There are other times where I'm just trying to get it to do something. And often that's some kind of, you know, activity that I want the game to run for the classroom. Okay. Now, it doesn't mean, and I go through all kinds of steps when I work with my clients, it doesn't mean that you let this unleashed on a student to right. get whatever answers back you want.
Right.
But often, you know, especially in experiential learning kind of frameworks, it will generate the challenges pretty well.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you wanted like 100 case studies on in nursing, which I'm doing right now with one professor, you know, it can generate those with pretty good accuracy.
Right.
But I wouldn't necessarily want that to be done in real time. Right. So mm-hmm. I'll have them stuck in a data file. I'll have someone human go through and curate and make sure they're accurate.
Yeah.
And then we just randomly pick from that file or serve them up to students in a certain order of difficulty.
Yeah.
As we're doing it. So I do a lot of work of that sort. On the other side, I do a lot of writing, as you know, and, you know, I don't find it very useful for writing.
Right.
And this falls in the category of kind of what we're talking about, right? Which was, you know, my writing is a lot better than it was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I didn't have anybody to give me feedback on my writing. Who likes to read a bad writer, right? So it was a lot of work and a lot of, you know, and eventually, you know, if you have that filter that you can, you know, critically look at what you're doing and you have that bent, you'll improve.
Yeah.
If I use AI to support me and provide constructive feedback mm-hmm. on what I'm doing, mm-hmm. I think that's actually one of the best roles. It's better at judging than it is at reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ask it to take something and evaluate it, it generally does, especially if you give it the criteria you want, it generally does a better job than if you ask it to go figure something out.
Right.
I generally can't enter a conversation with the AI knowing that I will get it to work. You know, this is a very different kind of technology than we're used to.
Yeah.
Right. In some ways, science fiction hasn't helped us. Right.
That's true.
Because, like, you know, all the AI, all the smart robots in sci-fi movies put out the right answer every time. They were logic machines. They were reason machines. These are anything but.
Right.
This is almost like an intuition. You can think of the AI as intuition on our rationalizations.
Right. Yeah.
Which may or may not translate.
Yeah. You could also call it a bullshit engine.
Yeah, bullshit engines have no basis in fact. I can't say that that's the case here. Well, it certainly can
I think, be. I think we're going to get into a next level conversation about the nature of bullshit, which is probably for the premium version of the podcast, which we haven't yet released. But it is interesting in that it was trained off of our bloviating to some extent, so that now there's a little bit of that kind of baked in to the model. The data that the LLMs were trained on is very much rife with misinformation and a lot of the problems that we have in social media over the last, 10 plus years. So it's not surprising that you don't look to these things for wisdom. You want to be sniffing to see whether they pass the sniff test, so to speak, in terms of what they're giving you. But that being said, there's a lot of design going into them to make them more like a familiar, like a pet, a co-pilot, a friend, so there is a level of emotional design that kind of has gone into the dynamic that we want to establish with them. And that's where the winner of our March Madness of Learning Trends was mental models, understandably, I think, because mental models, shout out to my wife who suggested that one, Dr. Robin Naughton. But the idea of a mental model is it is flexible. It's applicable to different contexts, and it's very much like the design that goes into building an AI. You want to think about what mental models do humans have when they think about engaging with this technology. And to me, that circles back to this idea of judgment, discernment, some of the other terms that I've been hearing lately around the types of skills and even the mindsets, perhaps, that humans need to be able to adopt to engage well with these things. I really liked your provocation. Sci-fi may have actually given us the wrong mental models, and it might be dangerous, even though I love sci-fi and I think it's useful to be able to explore those scenarios. It may actually be doing us a disservice in that perhaps we're breaking dystopian too fast when we need to be able to juggle different mental models. I'd love to hear a little more about your thinking. Like, what frameworks do you think make the most sense, and where do we want to maybe mature the thinking?
Now, I think the key thing just at the start of this conversation is to say it isn't one thing, right? Even if the chatbot is one thing, it can do many things, right? And you're in control of those many things. Yeah. So one of the ways that I think it's important to think about it is rather than us and them, I'm the user, the developers are over there in some AI company. You're an AI developer.
Yeah.
And the end of a conversation you have with an AI, it's a different AI behaving differently than anybody else's conversation.
Yeah.
And in some ways, the way to think of it, I thought Ethan Mollick had a very good point on a podcast this week when he said, one of the ways to think about it is it's trying to find a story with you.
Hmm.
Right? If you don't give it a good enough story, it's going to fill in the blanks.
Hmm.
Right? Hmm. So the power of using these systems is in being specific to your needs. And that is an art because I don't always know what I want.
Right.
And especially if it's a complicated task. Let's say I'm sitting down, I wanted to play around with how to use ChatGPT's API and software. Like, I hadn't coded and I used to do it for a living, but I have, I'm not a coder anymore. I wouldn't call myself that. But I still understand the principles, right? I wanted to see if code generation would allow me to just use the API, create a user interface, and play with it through that. And it turns out it wasn't that hard, but I couldn't know that when I had no idea what the strengths and weaknesses were.
Yeah.
I had no idea if it could even explain things well enough.
Right.
And so when that's the case, the wisdom or the judgment to understand how to approach the conversation then becomes paramount.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. If I don't even understand what questions to ask, where do I start? Well, I started with what's a good software stack for doing XYZ?
Right.
Just so I understand sort of where its scope is. And then I can neck down and piece things together.
Yeah.
Or I could ask it through what's called chain of thought prompting, where you kind of ask it to go through the process in steps.
Mm-hmm.
And by virtue of its output, which gets fed back into the model, it pays attention to what it's been saying.
Sure.
If you ask it to take intermediate steps, it's actually a form of teaching it new things.
Mm-hmm.
So these things are fairly complicated thinking processes, especially for young learners, right? And so one of the dangers of AI is if you're not going to be skilled using it, it's going to tell you what it tells you.
Right.
That's really when the concern of bias, for example, becomes more important, because you're letting it control the conversation. You're not controlling the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just writing, I've been writing a lot about bias. I put out an article recently, but
yes.
I've been writing so a much more extensive version of that.
Yeah, you're writing articles on LinkedIn, and we'll share a link to your recent article on bias in the show notes for this episode.
So one of the main points I was trying to bring across in this writing is it's often presented too simply, really too shallowly.
Mm-hmm.
It usually is something of the sort like, we have to worry about bias. The AI companies have to deal with that.
Right.
And both of those are true, but that's a very incomplete story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was trying to add nuance to that. Well, you know, that's the story that the AI has been trained on.
Right.
So when I'm asking it to describe something to me, it's giving me what I would call sort of worry without remedy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, pay attention, be worried. What do you do? Blame the AI companies and you tell them to fix it. Well, mm-hmm. it turns out you can fix it too, mm-hmm. right? In many cases, by how you talk to the AI, how you prompt it, how you interpret its information.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times that combination of you and the AI will be less biased. Sometimes the AI itself will be less biased, but the human is inserted bias.
Yeah.
So it's a very complicated subject. And I was trying to get that nuance and that complexity out mm-hmm. when I wrote about it. But the AI was not cooperating. You know, it wanted to write about those stories that I would call somewhat shallower stories.
Right.
And so, you know, I tried a little bit. And then I just said, this is a waste of time. I'm never going to get it. By the time I tell it what my point of view is, I could have written it, right?
Right, right.
And so, you know, that's a situation where, like, I knew what I wanted to say. I'm not sure what I expected the AI to help me with,
mm-hmm.
except, you know, hopefully it put out a few paragraphs that I only had to rewrite slightly or something like that. But the reality is, no, it didn't help me think through that because I had already spent the time thinking through it.
Right.
Now, if I'm given a new task for, you know, I'm working with a nursing school right now, you know, and I'm helping them develop some cases. That's a great example where I don't know anything about nursing.
Sure. Right?
I have a biomedically trained background. I can follow the language. I'm not an expert in understanding even how to describe what I want.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so in that case, the key is, well, you go find the authoritative things that you want to represent, right? The teacher has a syllabus. The teacher has an example case study they did before.
Mm-hmm.
There's a textbook that they refer to if students want more information. So I give the AI that instead of, you know, the lack of knowledge that I have.
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, this will change over time. And it may be that this is another conversation, but it may be that the way we prompt the AIs itself is not going to be quite this complicated in the future.
Yeah.
But that brings other dangers. You know, in the future, it may be that the AI just keeps asking you questions to pull it out of you.
Right. And also the AIs will get to know us better. The idea of a personal virtual assistant, a PVA. I like to joke about the PVA as the return of the PDA, just like the LLMs are the return of Clippy, where there were proto-technologies that were not really ready and kind of are on the dust heap of history. And yet 10, 15 years later, we're living through Clippy's revenge now, where there's a whole other level of competence on the other side. And when you were talking, it reminded me of the work, and I've done a couple episodes on the work of Andy Clark around the extended mind, where another way to think about these AIs and these bots is that they're actually just an extension of our minds, so that they're not even independent of us in terms of the outputs that we're getting back. And it is a way to kind of improve our thought cycles. Although, to your point, there are opportunity costs around using these things. And if misapplied, in addition to the problem of bias, there's also the problem of waste, where you just wasted time getting into an argument with an extension of yourself based on a huge data model. You could have just been doing the work. It's a very complex landscape nowadays. What do you think about the framing of a co-pilot? Because that is a mental model as relating to the AIs. I think there's some real upside around that, where like the benefit of the co-pilot is having someone who can kind of check the pilot and then also handle some of the more detailed components. The flip side is if you're co-piloting and neither of you is flying the plane, at least in the plane metaphor, that can be a problem. But what are your thoughts around some of those types of frames?
So I just want to make it clear that we're not talking about a specific product, because a lot of products now are called co-pilots.
Oh, sure. Yes, the broader term. Yes.
But the broader term of co-pilot, I think that's appropriate. However, it's not possible in some situations. So if you think about the educational world, for example, let me contrast that with the workplace. If the workplace is trying to get something done and AI happens to do it better than the person does it, the employer is going to take it, right?
Yeah.
Thumbs up.
Right? Somebody's getting a raise.
At some level, I just care that the work gets done, right?
Yeah.
I want my employees to develop along the way, but it's possible, not proven, but it's possible that just seeing how AI does it a lot will make them better at it eventually, okay? If they're paying attention at the wheel. However, imagine you're a sixth grade student. What kind of a co-pilot are you going to be from something that has a brain like that? Not a very good one for any subject at all,
right?
The AIs are trying to find a story with you. They're trying to make you happy at some level.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
But we don't want that for the student, right? Making the student happy is probably telling them the answer.
Right. Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. But the art of teaching is getting a student to generate the answer and asking the right questions, that you drag that out in a way that they learn something.
Right.
And so I don't want that AI to be a co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
There's not an equal pairing there. And so that's when what the AI is doing is really monumentally important and how they're behaving to that experience. I think in the workplace, the example I gave of the AI just doing it better, right? The big question there, as well as the person learning.
Right.
Right. If AI is now making it easier for a novice to act closer to what an expert can do, does that impede them from becoming an expert eventually?
Right.
Or does that accelerate the process? Right.
I refer to that as the training wheels problem, where my son started on training wheels and it actually kind of set him back. He's ramping up now at the scooter helps parenting tip, but had he not had the scaffold there and had he been forced to learn without it, I think cognitively, and it's not cognitive in this sense, it's, you know, physical, mechanical, his balance skills. Mm-hmm. But in the case of our cognitive skills, I think you get the wrong scaffolds in too soon. The ability to do it without scaffolding, I think, gets harder. And then there's also the risk of, why should I invest the time in developing this skill if the bots already have it? That's what I think around writing, where if you don't learn how to write, you don't really, from my perspective, and again, hindsight is 2020, and there's some cognitive dissonance here, but I learned how to think in a lot of ways by learning how to write unaided. And now if kids are learning how to write with an LLM, will they develop the ability to think that way that I did? And is it really necessary?
So I have two comments to this. One is that you're right, and there's that uncertainty that students may not learn to write as well as they once did. But let's look at the reality. Most of the world can't write very well. I mean, I would just tell you, as a supervisor of some really, really, really smart people, a lot of them didn't write well at all.
Yeah.
I went through most of my career, you know, I could put a scientific paper together. That's a particular style of writing and one that's not very artful, I guess I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not learn to communicate by writing. I learned to communicate by speaking.
Yeah.
Presentations were a common part of my job.
Yeah.
And my career. And I think that's one of the things, I'm going to say something probably really controversial. People decry the lack of reading and writing, but it's possible that that's just a reflection of the world changing.
Yeah.
Right. And in the very long-term sense, I wonder whether math and the written word are going to be important to humanity, or at least the same level of importance. Students can get their information by listening to a book. They can watch a video, which is more engaging.
For sure. They might even be able to listen to a podcast, Tim.
They'd be good, right? You know, there's a lot of different modes of getting information. Didn't used to be.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, like, you know, If I had a book in the encyclopedia,
right?
And you know, if you were lucky enough to be in a wealthy home to have one.
I also had the Super Friends and Warner Brothers cartoons on reruns too, which may tell folks a lot about what influenced me and how I turned out.
The idea that students are not learning as much as when we were kids is not consistent with what we know. So I had to piece this together through sort of multiple studies and multiple time periods. But the average person consumes something like 30 or 40 times more information than they did 20 or 30 years ago.
Right.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So obviously we're not retaining all of that. I hope we don't. I don't need to have that.
Right.
You know, that skateboard accent in my mind.
It also gets to your point about noise. And this is also where I wanted to give a shout out to the late Daniel Kahneman, who just recently passed. I actually learned of his passing from a LinkedIn post that you put out there talking about him, Thinking Fast and Slow, Behavioral Economics, really a lot of the roots of bias that are kind of inherent in how humans are designed to think. Can you maybe build a little more on the conversation about bias and then the role that noise can play? Because it does seem like all that information that's coming in is starting to create new cognitive challenges for us, which gets back to that idea of discernment and finding the signal within the noise.
Yeah. So, I mean, my summary of Daniel Kahneman's career is that he made us understand that we're really not good at many of the things we think we're good at.
Yeah.
And he really was studying judgment in particular. And judgment, of course, is at the center of almost everything we do. By that, I mean not just conscious deliberation, but also those intuitive judgments we make with really most of our decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you think of bias and noise, so bias is how far away in what we do or say or whatever from what we really want. AI or a person who's screening a resume and the person who's dark-skinned has a worse chance than someone who's light-skinned, if that were the case, and that happens consistently, that's a bias. If someone were really sleepy and not paying attention to some resumes, and some of those darker-skinned folks get put on the discard pile that shouldn't have been, but also some light-skinned folks do, then that's noise.
Mm-hmm.
So bias is a consistent, systematic distortion or error.
Mm-hmm.
And noise is randomness,
mm-hmm.
right? So the point I made in the article was, if you're an immigrant to the U.S. claiming asylum and you go to a judge, your odds of getting asylum are really all about which judge gets picked for you.
Mm.
Like, you're in a lottery because some judges have an 85% acceptance rate and some have a 15% acceptance rate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in that kind of a situation, your problem is there may in fact be people who are biased, ethically biased.
Right.
But in a mathematical sense, your problem is noise. It's the variability. It's the fact that we should have a system that puts out the same answer given the same case and we don't.
Right.
And so a lot of the time people talk about bias using the definition of that the legal and ethics worlds use. And that's fine. And there's another definition of bias, which, you know, Kahneman and the psychological world would talk about.
Right.
And the third kind is what the AI folks talk about.
Mm.
That's a math term.
Mm.
And that math term, it turns out, I can say that AI shouldn't have put that resume in the discard pile. Right. But it turns out that mistake may or may not be biased to the AI or to the people that build the AI. Because the way to fix a systematic error could be, I need to change the training set.
Right.
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 But it could also be that I just need to prompt the AI better so it doesn't have the chance to behave that way, decreasing the noise by giving it more specific prompting.
Reminds me of Hamlin's razor, which is never presume ill intent when ignorance is equally possible.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, because it does seem like our tendency is to see patterns maybe where they aren't there. It's also the spotlight effect is the other psychological phenomenon where you think people are thinking more about you than they actually are. So when you have an unfortunate circumstance, you immediately look for who caused this, who can I attribute blame to? You know, there is a lot of AI scapegoating potential here as well, where if there is a problem with an output, we can blame the AIs because they're the evil overlords.
That's right. That's right.
And
we overlook the other side of the parent, the other side of that co-pilot arrangement,
right,
which is us and the fact that we may be making a lot of errors.
And even moving upstream from the AI, there is someone who designed it. Like, those are humans. There are human, at least to this point, and this is the risk really around decision-making and judgment, you know, at least to this point, we can pretty much blame a human for anything bad that an AI is doing because we built them and we allowed them to get to the point that they're at. You disagree?
I do. And the reason is, you know, I've built some of these systems. I built, back in 1990, a small neural network, very small compared to today's standards, to distinguish the brain waves of people who might have multiple sclerosis from those who don't. And I can tell you that, you know, I knew what data went into that and I knew what answers came out of it. And I have no idea what happened in between, because this was a system that even at that time was too difficult to analyze.
Sure.
By looking under the hood. And sure. So what I would say, there are two problems with attributing all of this to the human. One is they don't actually know the implications of some of the choices they make.
Sure.
I mean, this is so new that, you know, they may be picking a tunable parameter setting that affects the learning rate of the machine. And that may have all kinds of implications on how biased it is on certain subjects.
Sure.
But they can't know that cause-effect relationship.
Right. I'm not saying we need to go, you know, fire up the DeLorean and go back in time so that they didn't make the wrong decision. I'm just saying, if you think about it from the context of human judgment and human decision-making, humans made the decisions that created the AI landscape that we have today. And then humans are interacting with those agents to make decisions, to make human judgments on the other end. And my point is, continuing to understand, so long as the humans are in the loop, what can we learn from the decision-making that the humans were doing really on both ends of the equation? It reminds me of Kevin Roos in his book, Future Proof, talks about how you basically don't want to be an endpoint. You don't want to be receiving an output from an AI and then that being what you need to do. You know, I think there is an element of almost elevating humanity, getting us to kind of like fulfill our fullest potential to actually be able to lead the AI, to be Fred Astaire to the AI's Ginger Rogers. Mm-hmm. I'm going to need a new metaphor because that one is certainly aging out because I was young.
When, I was going to say, between bringing up PDAs, old school PDAs.
And hey, that. Wisdom does accrue with age and with labor, you know, with the energy of really exerting yourself in productive struggle. And then remembering it and sort of fulfilling yourself through better decision-making in the future. Mandela, I quote all the time, I never lose, I either win or learn. We're at time here, Tim. It's been an amazing conversation. I'd love to have you back, but any concluding thoughts for our listeners? You know, we were talking a lot about bias. We were talking a lot about judgment. Concluding thoughts, takeaways for folks?
Yeah, I mean, I usually tell people one thing when it comes to AI, which is don't make up your mind. You know, I think there's a tendency for our whole world to go into camps, right? And actually, you know, when you look at what is the most important characteristic of somebody who's going to be a good judger, right, as Kahneman would talk about, it isn't intelligence, although that's important. It's open-mindedness. And by that, I mean not the willingness to listen, but the willingness to change your mind if new evidence presents, right? And so that's a pretty weak area for the human race right now.
Right.
And so when we think about weaknesses in this relationship with AI, we need to think about both sides. AI is good. There's a lot of things about AI that worry me quite a bit, but it's not a monolith and we shouldn't treat it that way.
Great stuff here with Tim Dacey. We'll include links to his book and the work that he's been doing on the show notes for the episode. Also, great follow, writing more articles on LinkedIn and elsewhere. Tim, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode.
Thank you, Michael. Keep up the good work.
And for our listeners, hopefully you enjoyed what you heard. If you did, please subscribe. This is Trending in Ed, but also be on the lookout for AI in Ed as we zero in on what's new and emerging in the world of learning with artificial intelligence. Thanks as always for listening.